You're listening to Cattails.
You're listening to Cattails, and I'm Cat. I call Paris and spend a very entertaining evening in the delightful company of Lucas Fox, co-founder of Motorhead, drummer with Warsaw Pact, and now member of Pink Fairies. He recounts lots of fascinating stories, divulges a few secrets, and reveals all about some risky as well as risque moments in his life. In this first tale of a two-part series, Lucas tells me about his early days, his big break into the music industry, a chance encounter with Keith Moon, Ringo Starr and Charlie Watts, and how his band, the W.H. Pierce Band, were recorded by Roger Waters. And of course, we chat about his first meeting with Lemmy and how Motorhead was born, but also about his obsession with ladies' lingerie and why he is spilling the beans on all of the sex and drugs in his forthcoming autobiography. This is the one with Lucas Fox.
How are you, Kat?
I'm very well, and how are you?
I'm very well, very well. Beautiful sunny day here in Montmartre. It's lovely here because I've got this little house in Montmartre, which is a village anyway, which is in Paris, but we all think of it as not in Paris because Paris, for to us, is down the hill a bit.
Yeah.
The other side of the boulevard.
Oh.
But I got this little house, and the biggest surprise about it, basically it's built as a stable for three horses and two hansom cabs.
All right.
And therefore, it's got a mezzanine where they used to put the hay.
Yeah.
And originally, it was basically just a roof that they'd stuck onto the wall of Montmartre, which starts right behind me, which is about 8 metres thick where I am.
Oh, blimey.
Yeah, it's like a fortress, you see, holding back the earth. And I hope it does hold back the earth. We don't have a mudslide, otherwise I'm dead. But yeah, and the big surprise when I moved in was that I set up my speakers. I have big studio speakers, which are about, I don't know, 1,000 watts each or something.
Uh-huh.
And so as usual, it's a lot of wood here, so it sounds great because it's all open beams and stuff.
Mm.
And goes up to the roof. It's a tiny house, tiny. It's a little doll's house. So I started cranking up the speakers and went out into the courtyard in front of me, a little garden in front of me, and to try and listen to it. And I couldn't hear anything. And I turned it up and turned it up and turned it up. And when I was at like top volume and I closed the door behind me, I could just about hear it in the courtyard.
Crikey. Sounds like you need 11,
yeah.
Don't you? You need to rank it up to 11, don't you?
Exactly. Well, I definitely think I'll add on an extra notch.
Those walls must be incredibly thick to hold all that back.
Well, that's right. I mean, they are. I mean, basically, as I say, it started off as just the roof that they put to shelter the horses from the rain and stuff. And then, of course, they built the walls around it. And it really is. And of course, you know, from my point of view, because I'm quite a sexual animal, it's great, of course, because the neighbours can't hear anything either. At all.
That's just as well, isn't it? Otherwise, there'll be all sorts of rumours going around.
Well, they can rumour all they like. I don't care. You know, I really don't care.
Once a rocker, always a rocker. That's what they always say, isn't it? Somewhere along the line, it's in everybody's blood, whether it's rock and roll
exactly.
Or whether it's something else. Oh, dear.
Absolutely.
So tell me, how did you end up in Paris?
How did I end up in Paris? I guess the short version of that was I was doing a lot of touring, and then at one point I wasn't touring and I was doing a lot of studio work. And my favourite sound engineer, who was off on tour with Iggy Pop or somebody doing a world tour, he came back and he said, "What are you doing for the next 6 weeks?" I said, "Oh, I've got this session and that session." He said, "No, you're going to be paid every day." And I went, "Ah, okay. What am I going to be doing?" He said, "I'm going to take you out on the road as a backline roadie and teach you the other side." And he did, and he was brilliant. Gary Hughes, great sound engineer. And he really taught me how to be an excellent, you know, not technician, but backline road crew and hands, putting up the PA, putting up the PA and lights every day, taking down every night. You know, really hard work. You're working sort of 12, 14-hour days or something, and sharing the driving as well of the truck. And, you know, it was great fun. I had a great time. So we did a 6-week tour. Do you remember Gordon Giltrap?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
He had a big hit with one of the BBC programs. He did to generate the music for it or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, pretty boring artist. But, I mean, he was very good at it. You know, it's 12 guitars, a whole empire of keyboards to put up and plug in right every night. And so it was quite stressful. Mm. But as a result of that, I'd worked with musicians all my life, obviously. Mm. I'd organised quite a few gigs for the bands I was in. I'd sort of also managed the bands I was in. And then suddenly I had this other side, which was, you know, up until then, for years, I'd been lucky enough to have road crew looking after my kit and setting it up and breaking it down every night. And suddenly I was on the other side. The foot was on the other boot, if you like.
Yes.
Suddenly I had a real feeling for road crew and stuff. And so what happened is I got a phone call out of the blue from MIDEM, which is the biggest, it's like Cannes Film Festival for Music.
Yeah.
The biggest music fair in the world.
Yeah.
In Cannes.
Right, yes.
And they called me up and said, look, you're bilingual, bicultural. And I said, yep, I went to a French school. I never went to an English school.
Uh-huh.
And they said, we know that you've done a lot of touring stuff, so you can handle musicians and all that side. And we hear that you've also done some technical work. You know, would you like to come and run our stages, Directeur Technique, as technical director?
Right.
As basically stage boss.
Yeah.
So I went, yeah, you bet. I haven't done that before. I didn't tell them that. I hadn't done it before. But I just sort of said, yes, you bet. You know, that'll earn me some dosh. And it sounds like, you know, getting out of London for a bit sounds great. And so off I went and did that the first year. And it went very, very well. And they gave me, the next year as well. And then they flew me over to be sitting for lunch with all the bosses of MIDEM and stuff, the guy who started it and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And they said, they were down the other end of the table, long table. And I heard this big row breaking out down the other end and they were screaming at each other and banging the table and being really antsy. And I sort of quietly said, what's going on?
Yeah.
They said, well, the guy that we got to do all the programming for January hasn't done it. And I said, wait a minute, we're in late October, right?
Oh, my.
Beginning of November. And there's no programming being done? They said, no. And do you know, it's one of those weird things in life which happens to me. I noticed my right hand creeping up into the air. And half of me was going, you're fucking mad. What are you doing? You know, get their hand down immediately, you know.
Yeah.
Programming. Do you have the contact to be able to do that? You know, and me being ballsy as fuck and also always a bit strapped for cash, I just thought, fuck it. What have I got to lose if it fucks up and I lose a bit of reputation? And it went really well. So the next 2 years I did, I ran all the stages for, and it was live TV to 15 countries with live bands.
Blimey.
So it was extremely hairy. It's great. Yeah. Great. What exciting time.
A bit of adrenaline rush,
that
is. And
so I ended up running, and I did run their shows and programming their shows 3 years.
Crikey.
So it was great. So that, if you like, amazing. Gave me the address book, because all the big record companies wanted to get their young artists on the Discovery show.
Mm.
So, of course, suddenly I was the person to know.
Yeah.
And they flew me all over the world because they'd had problems with changing over artists. But it was an hour and a half show. You know, there was no, like TV, you know, you haven't got 1 minute more, 1 minute, 1 minute less, yeah. Right? An hour and a half show. And of course, as soon as the first band was on, their problem, why they brought me in to do it, was because they couldn't change the acts fast enough.
Right.
And they were taking 3 to 5 minutes to change each act. Now, that's a long time on live TV.
Yeah.
To have someone going blah, 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 waiting for them to change over.
Yeah.
And so that was my challenge. Because you can imagine, you add up that into an hour and a half space. You've got, as soon as the first band's gone down, you've got another seven bands on the show.
Yeah.
Then you multiply 4 or 5 minutes between each band. You're, the star of the show walks on stage and the generic runs, you know, the credits run. Mm. And then it's closed, and the star doesn't even get looking.
Yeah.
So all the record companies are really mightily pissed off to fly their big stars out there and not get any TV out of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they flew me all over the world to go and talk to record companies in LA, in New York, etc. And I became someone who seemed to have a bit of importance, you see.
Terrific.
So that's how I moved to France, if you like, because suddenly I had loads of stuff to do and had... obviously a great address book by then, because,
yeah.
You know, all the record companies, you know, the heads of record companies were calling me up.
But you see, you must have been the perfect person for that, really, because you've obviously been on stage, so you knew the challenges of then suddenly getting all the musicians off, getting all the kit off, what kit has to be redone, what you can do for one band, then the next band, what you have to change. You had all that knowledge from the front, didn't you? So that must have come in handy.
Well, yeah, but I started at the age of nine.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, I started at the age of nine, which was in 1962, 63, 9, 10. And it was the big winter. And we hadn't got much money by then. I was brought up quite well in Kensington originally. I was born in Paddington, brought up in Kensington. And then the money ran out and my father's business started sliding. Mm. And so off we went to Chiswick, which in those days was a long way out. Now, of course, it's central London.
It is.
But in those days, it was a real suburb, you know.
Yeah.
And it was great. I loved it. Loved Chiswick. And we had a bigger house and stuff like that. But come my birthday, I was dying to have a drum kit. And I'd hang little signs all over the house saying, I need a drum kit. I want a drum kit. I must have a drum kit. All this stuff. And, like a young kid can. And my birthday came around. They moved my birthday forward because I was driving everybody so mad. My birthday was on the Monday. And they moved it forward to the Saturday. So I rushed downstairs expecting to see lots of boxes. And there was like two boxes, one with a snare drum and one with a stand and a tiny cymbal in it.
Oh.
And that was it because that's all they could afford.
Yeah.
So I went and saw my father was still in bed and I said, what am I going to do about it? Thanks very much. I love it. But, what am I going to do about the rest? And he just really dried. He said, well, if you're really serious, I mean, he's pissed off by it by this stage, fuck's sake, how ungrateful can a young boy be?
Yes.
And he said, well, if you're really serious, you'll find a way. And so I went straight downstairs, two at a time, roared into the kitchen, pulled on some warm clothes, grabbed a metal bucket from under the sink and a rag, because there weren't any sponges in those days, and went door to door in the snow trying to wash people's cars.
Oh, wow.
And that's how I got my first drum skicks. And then for a couple of years later, I washed cars to buy a kit.
Wow, what a wonderful story, Lucas. Oh, man, that's great. I mean, how many kids nowadays would do that? I mean, you must be quite proud of yourself there.
Well, I don't know. For me, it was desperation. It was absolute desperation. There was no pride there. I talk about it now, and people say, well, you couldn't do that now. It'd be illegal, You can't work at the age of nine.
Oh, that's right.
That's right, but that's kind of how it started. I went to the King Street Music Stores to buy my first set of real drumsticks, because up until then, my old man had used doweling rods.
Yes.
A dryer to dry clothes in with doweling rods,
Yes, I do.
Straight rods. And so he cut some of them down and rounded off the ends to make drumsticks for me.
Oh.
But of course, they weren't real drumsticks. They didn't have any spring in them, Dead as a doornail. And so off I went to King Street Music Stores, just down the road from Hamilton Podium, to buy my first pair of drumsticks.
Wow.
And that's when, as far as I can remember, I went in. One of my last clients had been an RAF drummer, and he'd said, listen, you must roll the sticks up and down the counter to make sure they're straight. And I had no idea why. Mm. But I thought, I'll do that. Seem a minimum professional. And there I am in King Street Music Stores, standing between one guy with a big nose and long hair on one side and another guy with a big nose and long hair on the other, and a guy who looks really old behind him. And I'm rolling my sticks up and down the counter, having, amassed my little piles of loose change that I had in my pocket to buy the sticks with. And it turns out that the guy on my right is Keith Moon, the guy on my left is Ringo Starr, and behind us Charlie Watts.
No!
So there I am standing at the age of 10 or something in King Street Music Stores, surrounded by, and of course it was before Beatlemania hit.
Yes, my goodness.
Later on that year, I went to the Hamilton Podium and saw the Beatles on stage, and I think it was the year after I saw the Stones on stage. When I was very young, I started seeing all these bands. It was great, We used to see them in the street and see the Who in the street in Chiswick High Road.
Oh, amazing.
And it was kind of normal, you see.
Yeah. But, things have changed.
We all just thought that was normal.
God. Incredible, isn't it? You see, you wouldn't get access to people like that these days, would you, if you're an inspiring young drummer? I mean, that kind of chance meeting doesn't come along these days, does it?
Well, I don't know. It probably does, because in the end, this was before they were famous, and the Stones were playing the Rick-a-Tick-Tick Club, and they weren't even playing the Crawdaddy yet, you see.
Yeah.
Charlie Watts had literally just joined the band in early 63. The Beatles were starting to make inroads, but it wasn't there yet. It wasn't the big, you know, there's still those first album, which was all covers, no original songs on the first album, as far as I can remember.
Yeah.
So you know, it was just like, but I think if you went into a music store at the age of 10 now, you'd probably be surrounded by a few drummers who are on their way up.
Yeah, I suppose that must be true, actually. Yes, we've got to have hope, haven't we?
Yes.
Well,
and from that point of view, I mean, somebody asked me the other day, he said, well, how did you get the big break, you know? Mm. And I said, well, at the age of 13, I was already playing bands, and that was terrifying, lumbering bits of kit on the underground, right?
Wow.
Part of your kit at the top of the escalator, part of your kit at the bottom, terrified that people are going to nick it, you know?
Yeah, God.
So, on my own. So it was all a bit like that, you see. And then when I went to art school when I was 17 and spent 6 months there and then left, and by 18 I was professional. But I'd already sussed out that the Melody Maker had the small ads in the back,
yeah,
looking for a, you know, drummer, no great heads and all this stuff. Mm. And so I knew how what I had to do, I'd call these ads up. And at the same time, I realised there was one club in London where all the stars went, all the big musicians went. It was the Speakeasy.
Yeah.
So I, bold as brass, as usual. But I didn't think I was being bold. I just thought I must do it. I must learn how these people, what makes them tick.
Yeah.
Because I was very young, I was only 18, they were all like 25, 26, 20, 29, 30 and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And had been touring for years and taking drugs for years. And I thought, I've got to work out what makes them tick, otherwise I'll never be able to fit in. For a start, I come from a different background, the French Lycée, I'm bilingual, I'm bicultural. They're often coming from Liverpool or Manchester or Glasgow or whatever,
mm-hmm,
from working class backgrounds, and I'm from kind of a penniless middle-class background.
So, you know what I mean? Know. Yes,
but,
I do.
But with a very good education.
Yes.
With a very good education, all the rest of it. So I'm kind of the odd man out wherever I am. But I'm in France, I'm not French, and I'm in England. Well, you got a weird education. You never had a school uniform and stuff like that.
Well, Lucas, let's just take a break now and listen to your work with the Pink Fairies from the latest album. This is the title track, Resident Reptiles.
We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Lucas Fock, founding drummer of Motorhead with Lemmy, and you're listening to Cat Tales, which is a wonderful program, and you should definitely adhere to this. Cat is a wonderful woman and really bright and everything I believe in. What a great program. Thanks for listening.
Carry on. So go on then. So your big break.
So I figured what I had to do was become a member of the Speedy Club, because I couldn't afford to pay every night. And I knew that I only had enough money for one warm beer to make it last all night. So fortunately, I managed to borrow my mum's car. And so I was actually mobile.
Yeah.
So I could get places and stuff. But I just went along to a speakeasy and lied about my age. And I never had a baby face. Well, you know what my face is like. even when I was young, I never had a baby face. So I always got away with... in fact, it's the other way around. When I was coming back from school, the least say out to Chiswick, every day they would say, you can't have a half fare.
Oh.
And in the end, I ended up carrying my birth certificate to prove that I was underage. You know? And finally, it got so embarrassing, I just played full fare. You know? So
oh dear, the hard life so obviously showed, didn't it?
Well, yeah, I paid my dues. You know, didn't realise I was doing it. I was just, you know, desperate to move on.
Yeah.
And start getting into real bands.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's how it started. And I lied about my age, got my membership card. And then I was hanging out in the place you needed to be.
Fabulous. Absolutely
so
fabulous.
That was kind of the deliberate effort to make a difference
yes.
to my life.
Mm.
But all the rest just fell into my lap, basically. I mean, I met Lemmy there by a mutual friend and stuff like that. And so that was years later. That was 4 years later or so.
Wow.
But by then, I was already playing in quite a lot of bands. I was in a band called the W.H. Pierce Band doing pub rock
right.
in 1973, I think. I must have been 20. And, that was two years before Motorhead. And they were taken under the wing of Pink Floyd.
Okay.
And we used Pink Floyd's Martin's Bins before Dave Martin became a worldwide make.
Yeah.
And the Pink Floyd therefore sponsored it, and Alan and Heath, we had a little Alan Heath mixer and a Martin PA supplied by Pink Floyd. And we ended up going to record at Dave Mason's place in Islington.
Yeah.
So there I was at the age of 20, being recorded by Dave Mason and Roger Waters.
Terrific. I mean, that must have been surreal as
well. It was totally surreal. Of course it was. But it was the week the Dark Side of the Moon went to the top 10 in the States. Overnight they'd become millionaires or something.
Amazing.
The recording wasn't very good. We were a raunchy, dirty pub rock band,
yeah.
R&B, and it came out sounding like kind of sub Pink Floyd. it wasn't very successful.
It wasn't the most successful in moment
band,
of your life.
Yeah, there was a, no, it wasn't. In that band, there was a bass player who came along, we auditioned, we needed a bass player, and Dave Ambrose turned up. Dave Ambrose had spent the last few years in... Do you remember Brian Auger and Judy Driscoll, Trinity?
Yes, I do.
Well, you remember Ab Fab?
Yeah.
Ab Fab,
yes.
The TV programme.
Yeah.
Wheels on fire,
that's
rolling
it.
Down
yeah.
the road. Right, okay. So that was Dave Ambrose playing bass on it.
Oh, right, okay.
And then he went on to Arthur Brown... And his Crazy World of Fire,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he was a bit damaged by all that because he'd been doing a lot of touring and a lot of drugs. And he's a really lovely guy. So he and Martin, the guitarist, and I became a really close unit.
Yeah.
And the other two who were W.H. Pierce Band, who were both art school teachers, finally it fell apart. And so we continued a little bit on our own. And then Dave Ambrose got an offer for our band to be signed to a major, but at the same time he got an offer for himself to go and be high up in EMI publishing.
Wow.
And so he took that, so we didn't get signed.
Oh.
And the band broke up.
That's probably just as well by the
sound
of it, though.
I don't know. It was also around that time my mother died as well. So it's you know, suddenly I was without a mother and without a band.
Yeah.
It was pretty hard
yeah.
At the time. I was only 20 and she was 53.
Mm.
So and she, I was very close to my mum. She's great. She, mm. You'd have loved her. She was a real trooper. She's great.
Bless her. Too early to go.
So, yeah. So then I went on to play with all sorts of other bands, including, I can't remember what they're called, Spangled Mob or something. And we did all the RAF bases up and down Britain. So that actually got me to get used to that sort of touring thing.
Mm.
And we supported the Bay City Rollers at Scunthorpe Bar Halls with Screaming Girls and stuff.
So the
bands I was in seemed to be very popular with the girls. So I got laid a lot.
So you were happy.
I was happy, exactly. And that kind of that part of my life going properly as well. Because I started, my sex life started incredibly early, around the age of 11 or something. Oh, and I started getting laid at 14. Yeah. So it's a bit of a strange life from lots of points of view. I became obsessed by women's lingerie, underwear.
Yeah.
Around that time when I got taken to the circus.
Oh,
and I can remember the first visible erection I had in my life that I can remember was at the circus with all these trampoline artists dressed in G-strings, Diamante G-strings, and I just thought it was wonderful. So,
that
was kind of when my sex life started.
I love that, the first time in public, I love that bit. remember?
First of many, I must admit. But as you can tell, I'm not particularly bashful about it. On the contrary,
You see, that's the French influence coming out there, isn't it, compared to the British side?
Well, yes, I think it is. I can remember in the early 70s, I had these banana-coloured moon pants in cotton, which I didn't realise but were totally see-through. I found men's underwear incredibly uncomfortable. I used to ride horses and sit on my drum stool for hours and hours. And I just found men's underwears, the elastic would cut into my poor little buttocks, and that wasn't comfortable. So I ended up not wearing knickers for a long time. And I used to get fooled by lots of women, lots of my experiences were with older women. It's like 30, 35, when I was, 12, 13, 14, 15, etc. So I was very well educated on the women's side by a great sister and great mother, great aunt, who was just gorgeous. And our char lady, who was just Molly, she was amazing. And she taught me about the whole of the working class side, which is great. Because then I had the full shebang. I mean, my father was born in poverty in the East End, and he was basically a cockney that dragged himself up by the bootstraps and stuff.
Mm.
So it wasn't like it was completely unfamiliar.
Yeah.
Even though, I got sent to one of the best schools probably in the world, in the lycée at the time, Clark. That was an amazing place, the 2,500 kids from the age of 4 to the age of 19.
Right.
So it's quite a big school.
Yeah.
And of course, most of the kids were being moved from country to country.
Yeah.
Because that was the whole principle of the lycée, that you could go from country to country and where, whatever lycée you were in, you'd be doing the same class as you were, you'd be in sync with the classes.
Mm. Wow.
So, and it was also the McCarthy era, at the end of the 50s, early 60s. So we had a lot of Americans who didn't want an American education for their children.
Right.
Because it was so anti-communist and anti all that stuff.
Yes.
And also French kids, it was free for French kids. And French kids who we had in our classes, who their father, for instance, had set up a little import-export vegetable business.
Right.
And he'd started, these guys had started on a bicycle festooned with enormous amounts of onions, going over on the ferry every day to sell onions in Britain, finally getting to London, setting up their tiny little shop and living five to a room above it.
Crikey, that's stereotypical as well, isn't it?
isn't it? And of course, therefore, in this class, you had multimillionaires and lords and ladies of sons and daughters and diplomats' kids, but also these people who had absolutely nothing. It was great. So you had the perfect mix. And believe me, some of those millionaires' kids were wonderful. Some were complete arseholes.
Mm.
And some of the poor kids were wonderful and some were arseholes. So it also taught you that it's not quite a question of money.
Yeah.
And of course, because they were moved from school to school, from country to country. Discipline was not a word that you could use at the provincial say at the time.
Yeah.
And, we had some real terrors in the school. They were great. I can remember people smoking at the back of the class and stubbing cigarettes out on each other's hands and stuff. And there were even chain fights in the new barn in school. We're talking about South Kensington, in the early 60s.
Wow.
The local boys' school hated us because we were allowed to have long hair and wear the clothes we wanted, and they had to have short hair and uniforms.
Oh.
So it's an odd mix, you see.
It certainly is.
That's why I say I'm a rather odd bod. Lots of points of view.
You may say that, Lucas, but I couldn't possibly comment.
you comment all your life, because I'm wide open to anything you want to say. No problem. You know me now, Kat.
It's
a pleasure
to absolutely
know you.
Do you know what the thing is? It sounds to me like all this was great grounding, really, for when it all started to really take off for you. And of course, the pivotal moment's got to be the Motorhead moment, hasn't it? But it sounds like it's all the foundations were set very early for you. So when that came along, you were almost like ready and raring to go. You know, you've got the sex education behind you, you've got the rebellion.
You'd think so. I was definitely ready and raring to go and had enough experience.
Hmm.
But the thing that gobsmacked me and basically blew it for me was also the drugs, that I hadn't got enough experience of amphetamine sulfate to name but one.
Mm.
And that was my undoing as well.
Yeah.
And believe me, when it happens overnight, when you're suddenly you got your photograph in New Musical Express or Double Page Spread and all that stuff, and all these arseholes who never liked you in the first place down in Nottingham Gate where I was living would suddenly start wanting to buy you drinks and stuff.
Yeah.
And your head swells. You can never tell how this fame thing's going to work with people.
No.
Because it's an old joke. How does it go? If an artist is successful, it's because he's a genius. If an artist is not successful, it's because the management is crap.
Yeah. That's so true. You hear that so often, don't you?
You do, don't you?
Yeah.
So it's also, what does it do to a young kid of 22 who's basically hung out with people 4 or 5 years older than him from the age of 12, 13, 14. What does that do to you when it suddenly happens? Where you suddenly go, well, I've been discovered. They've realised I'm brilliant.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is not true. Mm. The hard work starts then. So it's post-Motorhead that my enjoyment career started really kicking in. Motorhead was great.
Yeah.
And Lemmy and I had been hanging out for a long time beforehand, because we'd met in the speakeasy in 1974.
Yeah.
And so we were hanging out while he was still in Hawkwind, and I was useful because I had a car.
Yeah.
And then we never drove.
Yeah.
Therefore, but we also had so many things in common. We were both obsessed by the Second World War. Mm. His father was a vicar. My grandfather was a vicar. We both rode horses. Lemmy loved horses.
Mm.
So we had a lot in common, riding horses, riding women. And he was also very respectful towards women, which was unusual for the time.
Yes.
And so was I, because I was well-educated. I never, ever had that thing which young boys have where suddenly half of the world becomes inferior because they're women. What the fuck about? Nonsense.
Yeah.
Absolute nonsense.
Mm.
So we had loads in common. And the whole thing about both of us, in our own way, it suffered from the whole thing of, Britain was great then, and we were the heroes and this crap. And you sort of go, well, wait a minute. What about the German people? Were they all nasty? They all became Nazi, yes, because they were forced to, otherwise they couldn't work and stuff like that. And so I started really getting into that. I studied it.
Yeah.
I really studied it. And again, their uniforms, the uniforms designed by Hugo Boss were so much sexier than the uniforms that we had, which are these khaki drab, rather badly cut, even officers' uniforms, even when they were well cut, just didn't have it the same way as an SS uniform.
Yeah.
So it was also the imagery started there. We were both obsessed by imagery.
Mm.
And the German fighter planes always looked far meaner than the Spitfire. I love that Spitfire. What a great plane, and the blankets and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But, beautiful, but compared to a Messerschmitt 109 or Heinkel bomber or those, they just look so much more dangerous. Stuka, you know, Stuka with its V wings and stuff.
Yeah.
With that siren in the front. So Lemmy and I had so much in common on all these things. We used to chat about the Second World War for forever, you know. And I'd amass a whole collection of books about elite regiments and the uniform and stuff. So we pored over those for hours while he was still in Hawkwind and stuff.
Yeah.
And we had the same sort of taste in music. I was very into indie rock because I'd been, well, it wasn't even called indie rock then, because I'd been in R&B bands and stuff. I was very hooked into, all the R&B bands at the time and Fleetwood Mac and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I'd been to going to the Marquee for a long time as well. I actually saw Led Zeppelin in front of 300 people at the Marquee.
Wow.
And Rod Stewart, The Faces, all those. We used to see them loads of times. Yeah. So I was spoilt, really, from the point of view, you know, I really had seen pretty much all there was to see, you know.
Yeah.
In great circumstances of, you know, the Marquee, 300 people.
Yeah.
And same sort of thing, you know. I can remember we used to walk back from the Marquee to Chiswick. We hadn't got enough money to take a taxi and the buses had finished. There were no night buses at the time.
Yeah.
So, blimey. Amazing parents. They actually didn't worry too much. If it hadn't been me with my children, I'd be worried out of my mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
To know your kids are walking back across town all the way to Chiswick. But again, it was times are different then.
Yes, exactly. You know, exactly.
Different times.
That's all we have time for in this episode, but listen to the other one with Lucas Fox to hear the rest of our conversation and lots more stories that you don't want to miss.
You've been listening to Cattails.
To listen again to this and other tales, go to cattails.co.uk.